Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisisCLE.com/podcast.
The Book Program, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. My first guest is Kate Russell, who started writing about technology, gaming, and the internet in 1995, and for over a decade has been a regular face on the BBC's flagship technology programme, Click. In 2014, she published her first novel, Elite, Mostly Harmless. Her latest, A Bookkeeper's Guide to Practical Sorcery, is young adult teen fiction, with the audiobook version read by the Archers actor Charles Collingwood. Also with us is Julia Heberlin, who's an award-winning journalist who's edited numerous real-life thriller stories, as well as writing the Radio 2 book club pick Black Eyed Susans. The follow-up, Paper Ghosts, is about a photographer who may or may not have dementia, and he may or may not be a serial killer. Also with us is Derek B. Miller, who's the director of the Policy Lab and has worked in international affairs with the UN, governments and think tanks for the past 20 years. He's the author of the novels Norwegian by Night and The Girl in Green. His latest, American by Day, is set in upstate New York during the 2008 election season. It's a thrilling race against time crime story and a personal journey through grief. And finally on tonight's book show is Sue Roberts, who's always wanted to write a novel. Well, now she has. Her debut, My Big Greek Summer, is out now. It's a feel-good romantic comedy about second chances set on a sun-drenched Greek island. That's all on tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Kate Russell, who started writing about technology, gaming and the internet in 1995 and for over a decade has been a regular face on the BBC's flagship technology programme, Click. Her first book, Working the Cloud, delivered a collection of online tips, tricks and resources for small businesses, startups and entrepreneurs. In 2014, she published her first novel, a sci-fi story based on a remake of the computer game that first sparked her interest in technology back in 1984. The book is called Elite, Mostly Harmless. But more recently, she had a new novel out in 2016, A Bookkeeper's Guide to Practical Sorcery. It's a young adult teen fantasy fiction story. And the audiobook version is out now, read by Charles Collingwood. So lots to talk about. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm all right. Thanks very much for joining us. I understand you're very busy. It's nonstop.
It is. Do you know what? This week, I mean, it's conference time of year at the moment. So this week I've got a conference tomorrow in London, a conference on Wednesday in London. Then I'm flying from London to Luxembourg for a conference on Thursday. And then I'm flying from Luxembourg to Amsterdam for a conference on Friday. And then I get to come home again.
Oh,
so,
wow.
Yeah, it's mad this time of year. And very exciting.
What happens at these conferences?
So I'm a technology reporter. I've been reporting on technology, as you said, since 1995. So really since the birth of the internet, birth of the popular internet, the World Wide Web. And as a result, I've got to see through my work the evolution of technical advances and digital transformation, everyone calls it, in business now, really from a point where it was very much a niche topic, where only businesses that were directly involved in sort of like the hard wiring of network infrastructure wanted to talk about it, to today, where Every business is a tech business. You know, I speak at human resources conferences. I'm speaking at a conference about the smart home this week. I'm going to speak for the financial industry in Luxembourg, and customer services is another conference this week. So there are all of these different elements of business now that, and everybody's kind of more and more aware of the fact if they don't get on board with the new cutting edge intelligent technologies. We've seen tech sort of advancing in leaps and bounds, but what's happening now, interestingly, is it's the thinking part of technology that's really growing. So machine intelligence, people call it artificial intelligence, although purists would tell you there is no such thing as artificial intelligence yet, it's machine intelligence. But we're using these big data algorithms and collecting all of the information that you give businesses, and it's allowing them to make intelligent decisions about how they interact with you, predict what you want, to give you better service. And, you know, we saw with Cambridge Analytica and Facebook recently, data can be used to manipulate us and try and push us and pull us in different directions. And in the same ways that was used for political reasons, businesses are using that as a smart way to, in some ways, counteract the fact that advertising in the traditional sense doesn't work anymore. You know, everyone's got content on demand, streaming. Nobody really watches adverts anymore. Nobody really watches, or not as many people watch linear television anymore. So it's a very interesting space at the moment, and everybody wants to talk about it. So I literally will say, OK, what's the conference about? What's the audience? And then I'll say, OK, what do I know about technology that might help you form your business views in the future?
And being a technology expert, if you like, it must be difficult to keep on top of the ever-changing news.
Yeah, it's impossible, really. I don't get this so much anymore, but when I first started speaking at business conferences, I used to get a lot of people ask the question, how do I keep up with all of the technologies? Because they're changing so fast. And I'm like, you don't, basically. I'm 50 this year. In fact, I'm 50 next month.
You don't look it, my goodness.
Thank you. Well, there's something to be said for staying indoors on computers your whole life rather than going out in the sun. But when I was a kid, and even when I was a teenager and a young adult, everything about my world, everything that influenced me, I could touch it, I could see it, I could feel it physically. And kids today, they grow up in a world where their horizons are so much further away from them, and they get touched emotionally by events that happen on the other side of the world, be that animal cruelty or terrorism or famine or political unrest. And young people are touched by these things, and I think they grow up understanding that they have a much more granular approach to their life. They don't feel the need to control everything in their life because they've grown up with so much of it out of their reach. Whereas certainly for my generation, and actually for my grandparents' generation even more so, they get panicked when they don't understand something that influences their life. Because when they were a kid, they could physically feel and touch and understand everything. So I think we have to begin to learn to become less grabby about the knowledge that we have and become more specialists. But it also means we've got to learn to be more trusting. We've got to learn to give out areas of our life and say, look, I don't have time to understand that. So I need to get people around me who can specialise in that. And then we share knowledge and share resources. And I think that's the key to not panicking about the speed of technological change, is just say, OK, I just want to understand one thing about my tech life. Get that right. Trust other people to do the other bits. And when I've got the bit that I understand right, then you can think about, OK, what else do I want to learn about?
You've explained it beautifully well. I think so many people have the opposite view from the point of view that, you know, when they were younger, life was more simple and they'd go outside and play football more, whereas kids today are spending too much time in a virtual world, if you like.
Yeah, well, you know, for good or for bad, whatever your feelings are about that, the fact is that young people are going to grow up to live and work in a world where the screen is everything, you know, where, and in fact, more than that, there's research from Gartner that says that by 2020, which is only a year and a half from now, 30% of all web browsing sessions will be done screenless. So we're now getting into conversational user interfaces. We're using voice assistants. So your young kids need to learn how to interact with the world they're going to be part of. And yes, getting outside and doing exercise is important. But if you try and deny them screen time, saying, you know, oh, that'll come later in life, then you're kind of, it's a bit like denying them how to, you know, read and write. It's going to be such an intrinsic part of their life that it will be of benefit to young people if it's second nature to them using this technology as they grow up.
Yeah, absolutely. So how did you get into writing physical books?
The only thing I've ever wanted to do my whole entire life was write stories. And when I say write stories, I don't just mean fiction. All of my life today is about writing. The technology reporting, it starts as a written piece. The presenting at conferences, it starts as a written piece. And I love telling stories, be they stories about facts or stories about fiction. And for me, really, a strong narrative really helps information to sink in. So the only thing I ever wanted to do was write. And even so much so that when I was a small child, if I had an argument with my parents, I used to go up to my room and write notes and fly them down the stairs on aeroplanes, on paper aeroplanes, because it was the only way I could really truly get my sort of words out, was actually to put them on a piece of paper. But I left school at 16. I had no qualifications. I didn't really get on with academia and never thought that I would have the opportunity, luck, providence, whatever. An opportunity came to me in 1995 and I was able to turn it around and become writing games, actually reviewing games for magazines, and then just carried on writing in my spare time my fiction until eventually I had the opportunity, as you said, back in 2014 to publish my first novel.
And tell us a little bit about it, can you?
So basically, the lucky break that got me into television was at the age of 15 in 1984, my brother got into computers and we got a BBC Micro at home. And I went to an all-girls school where, you know, we had a home economics lab where we learned to bake and sew, but we didn't have computers. But I really fell in love with the BBC Micro, and it had on it a game called Elite, which was a space trading game in a sort of a 3D line-drawn universe. And at the time, it was such a fundamental leap forward. It was the first time we had home computers. And inside this box on the kitchen table was this sort of seemingly infinite. It was actually a one-to-one scale model of the galaxy. And that was just like mind-blowing back in 1984. And today it's like, oh yeah, that happens all the time. But to have a world living inside a box on the kitchen table was just absolutely mind-blowing. So I fell in love with the game. I fell in love with computers. And then one of my customers actually ended up going into sales. One of my customers dared me to phone up an advert. Nickelodeon were looking for a young and funky female presenter who knew about games, and because I was a gamer, and even back in 95 it was quite unusual to be a gamer as a girl, and although I was 26, not so much a girl. And he dared me to phone up, and I phoned up and I got the job, and that was how I ended up working in television. But then as people got to know me, they became aware of my love of the game Elite. And it turns out that a lot of computer professionals today, they became interested in technology because the game Elite. Wow. So we shared this in common. But the game franchise, it didn't have a sequel for 21 years. I guess it was 2012. They ran a Kickstarter to fund the 21st century imagination of their game Elite. So many people pitched in for this, and one of the pledge tiers in their Kickstarter was to buy a license to write a piece of fiction based in the game world. And it was £4,500, and you got to also name a planet in the game world and name a star system and name a space station. And a load of people on the forum who I was sort of supporting their Kickstarter because I wanted to play the game again just as a fan. A load of people knew me from my work on television, and they all kind of encouraged me to buy a license to write a piece of fiction. And then I crowdfunded it myself, so they supported me to the tune of £17,500 in the end.
Wow.
To buy this license to write this book, and that we included a stretch goal to make the audiobook. But that's how it came about. I then found myself, I was literally just finishing actually writing my business book, Working the Cloud, when this happened. I was so busy. But I was like, okay, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. You're right. It's a great opportunity. I'm going to buy this this writer's pack, and I'll have to write the book over the next sort of year and a half. But I had no idea what the story was. Literally, I just was like, it'll be about space pirates in space. That's pretty much all I know. And everyone was just like, yeah, let's do it. And I think it was the enthusiasm about the game, and you know, they'd waited such a long time for the sequel, and everyone was sort of really kind of G'd up about it. They were just throwing their money at anything that was Elite related. So then I wrote the book over the next year and a half, and was very relieved when it turned out, you know, pretty good and got some pretty good reviews. So that was really the first published piece of fiction that I had.
Fantastic. And then a couple of years later, A Bookkeeper's Guide to Practical Sorcery, which is a young adult, isn't it?
Yes. Well, A Bookkeeper's Guide to Practical Sorcery is actually my first album. I don't know if you know this theory, but I've got some muso friends, and they were explaining to me, when somebody releases a first album, music album, it's really good because it's like their whole life work up until the point that they got signed, kind of like honed and refined. Then they get signed, then the album gets out, and then they have to churn out more albums. And so they're never quite as good as that first album, never quite as sort of, you know, deep and thoughtful. A Bookkeeper's Guide to Practical Sorcery is the first novel I ever finished writing. And I finished writing it about 10 years before it was published. Because it was the first novel that I ever finished writing, it was probably the first long-form story that I ever started thinking about, you know, probably as long ago as 20, 25 years ago, just thinking, because for me, writing stories always begins with a what if. You know, what if this happened, or what if that were the case, or what if you found this thing, or what if this person said this thing to this person? So, you know, that those kind of ideas of those what ifs really for me formed the seeds of the ideas of stories. So this was a story that was in my head from like when I was a kid. Wrote it. I had time in my diary about 14, 15 years ago. Got it finished. I sent it around to a load of publishers, but at the time, Harry Potter was just becoming to be really big.
Right.
And I actually got, and it's about a trainee wizard, and I got a note back actually from Faber and Faber saying, we really like the way it's written, but unfortunately, there's only really room for one trainee wizard in the literary world at the moment. So, you know, no thanks. And I thought, I'll put it in a bottom drawer. But yeah, it's been in my bottom drawer for like 10 or 12 years. And then when my publisher, Dan, who published my sci-fi, Elite Mostly Harmless, I said to him, oh, I've got something else you might be interested in looking at. And I sent it over to him. He was just like, yep, want that now. And I was like, wait, hang on, I need to do a rewrite, because I'd finished writing it 10 years before. And I've learned a lot about writing. I've probably written, you know, billions of words through my magazine work and reporting work as well. So I had to do a rewrite, wrote a new character in, wrote some more backstory and a bit more sort of complex stuff. It's really interesting going back to something that you finished 10 years ago and rewriting it, because you can actually begin to weave things, ideas into earlier parts of the book that support things that happen later on. It's quite a good process to go through.
Yeah. And can you tell us a little bit more about your trainee wizard?
Yeah, so his name is Henry Noble. He lives in this strange and quirky kind of kingdom or land, which is reminiscent of the sort of old fairy tale kingdoms, with kind of like monsters and beasts, and not orcs, they're called Macabon, our equivalent of orcs. But there is magic and kind of all of that intrigue. But I wanted it to feel kind of quirkily modern as well. So you'll find that there are glossy sort of headquarters of corporate enterprises and things like that. So it's kind of this quirky fairy tale / modern world. And for me, it was really important. When I was growing up, I was always into science and technology. So I'm a very logical person, but I love the idea of magic, you know, and I think that there needs to be unexplained things in the world, as well as all the stuff that we know about and we can learn about. I think you need to maintain the wonder in life by having some things that are just mysterious and magical. But for me, magic, you can't just give someone a stick, call it a wand, and have an endless supply of magic. There is no tension in that. There is no danger in that. It's just like, oh, I've got this magical stick that gives me magic, so every problem solved. So I really wanted there to be a science behind magic. So I worked really hard at the actual science of magic, you know, where the magic comes from, how the magic is flavoured, how it becomes spells. So for me, that was a really important thrust of the book, is Henry learning to become a wizard. And with him, we learn, you know, about this kind of working science of magic. And even to the point where, so do you know why people wear pointed hats, tall, pointy hats?
No.
So magicians wear tall pointy hats. Number one, because it makes them easy to spot in the crowd, obviously. And, you know, it's good to find your wizard when you need your wizard. But mainly it's a spell, a brain power enhancer. So a bit like if you cut the tip off of a cone and spoke through it, it would make your voice louder. If you've got the coned hat on your head, the magic going around inside your head becomes louder because of the cone shape of the hat. So it's all sort of little touches like that, that there's an actual workable practical science to magic. And that's why it's the Bookkeeper's Guide to Practical Sorcery.
And
so
Henry's
always wanted to be a wizard, but he ends up having to become an accountant because his father goes missing. And it's really his kind of like coming of age story and a journey story for him and his friends as they go off and do adventures. I'll just put it that way.
Yeah. Oh, great stuff. And being read by Charles Collingwood, that's fantastic.
Yes,
from The Archers.
I know. So he's Brian Aldridge from The Archers, those of you I'm sure you all know. And he's got this wonderful little gentleman's voice like this. And when I heard him, I was actually listening to... So I voiced the audiobook for Mostly Harmless, for Elite Mostly Harmless. That was me reading that, and that was fine because the protagonist was a female and it felt right in my voice. But when I wrote A Bookkeeper's Guide to Practical Sorcery, I heard an old grandfather reading it. You know, it was a real... That was very much the voice that was in my head. So although I'm a complete control freak, I was like, ugh. You know, I can't really read this. It's not my voice that should be the narration of this book. When I heard him reading a part in Cloud Atlas, the audiobook, and I was just like, immediately that I heard it, I didn't know who it was immediately, when I was listening to it, and I sort of just stopped in my stride and was just like, that's the voice I need for Bookkeeper's Guide. So got in touch with his agent, and bless him, he said... Oh, we crowdfunded it, by the way. So again, my wonderful supporters stepped in and helped me raise the £7,000 I needed to actually pay for his fee and the studio recording fee and everything. When I was sort of with him doing the recording, I said to him, I was really, really grateful. He'd read the book first. He asked for a copy before he said yes. I said, I was really grateful that you were... that you agreed to do this, because you really are just, you're the voice that I heard in my head. He said, today, these days, I could pretty much take work if I want to and not if I don't, because he still does The Archers, obviously. He said, I thought this would be a nice thing for my grandchildren to hear after I'm dead.
Oh,
okay. I don't really want to think about that, but that's kind of sweet.
Oh, bless him. Well, if people want to get a copy of A Bookkeeper's Guide to Practical Sorcery, it is out now with the audio book as well. And we've been chatting to the author, Kate Russell. Kate, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is award-winning journalist Julia Heberlin. She has edited numerous real-life thriller stories, including a series on the perplexing and tragic murders of girls buried in the Mexican desert and another on domestic violence. But she's with us on the Book Show to talk about her latest novel. It's called Paper Ghosts, and it's the follow-up to the Sunday Times bestseller and Radio 2 book club pick, Black-Eyed Susans. Welcome to the Book Show, Julia.
Oh, thank you for having me.
A pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us. And you're in the UK doing a bit of a tour, are you?
Yes, I am. Doing a couple of events at Waterstones and also talking to media like you.
Great. And are you enjoying it? Do you like this part of it?
I love London. I'm mostly an introverted person, so this always takes a lot of... what's the word? I have to gear myself up for this, but I love the people here and I have a great time, and the UK is always so kind and generous to me. I say they're charming, like Southerners are in Texas. That's
yeah.
What I think of them like.
Oh, good. That's good to hear. So before we talk about your latest book, tell me a little bit about when I mentioned in the introduction about writing about numerous real-life thriller stories. How did all that come about?
I was a journalist for about 20 years, and I was a features editor over a number of people who, you know, wrote arts and narrative journalism, and we usually did one sort of investigative project a year in our department, and I actually did not write much then. I mostly edited other people, but I was always fascinated with crime stories, not as they happen so much, but after the fact, what happened to the victim, what happened to the killer. And so I sort of carry that theme over into my books. But there were a number of, you know, very interesting cases we looked into. One was of Darlie Routier, who was convicted of killing her children, but has always declared her innocence and still sits on death row. And she was a very bubbly, suburban, blonde Texas housewife. And the story that you mentioned about girls who died in the Mexican desert, we thought that we had figured out who was doing this, which gang was doing this, but those murders have gone on and on for years, and that man is dead. So unfortunately, in Mexico, it's a fact of life that girls who travel from their factory jobs back home can end up dead in the desert, and the cartels are so busy over there. It's very sad.
Gosh, absolutely awful. And the case you mentioned about the suburban Texas housewife who supposedly killed her children, it's weird, isn't it, when you hear of these cases, to try and understand what's gone on in someone's head to do something so awful, who seemingly seemed a normal person.
Right, seemingly seemed a normal person. And one of the reasons, I mean, she still declares her innocence. She's divorced from her husband now. He still, I believe, says she's innocent. But one of the things that she claims got her convicted is that I think on her son's birthday, one of her dead son's birthday, very soon after this happened, she played with silly string at his grave. And the jurors saw that scene. And so her argument, I think her lawyer's argument, is that locked her in her mind as a crazy person when she was really just trying to celebrate her child's life. So who knows? There is now new DNA evidence that's being appealed. I don't want to say whether she's guilty or not, but the evidence certainly pointed that way. She claimed an intruder came into their home while they slept, and apparently she also stabbed herself.
Gosh.
So anyway, it's a very complicated crime. But like you say, it's how could somebody do this?
Mm, absolutely.
So and for why?
Yeah, for sure. So for people who haven't read the first book, Black Eyed Susans, can you just tell us a little bit about what happens in the book?
Black Eyed Susans goes back and forth between Tessa and Tessie. And Tessie is a young girl who is found in a field of black-eyed Susans, barely alive, with a bunch of old bones scattered around her. She's only 16 at the time. So the book discusses that aspect of her life as she sits in a psychiatrist's office. Those are very sort of intimate sessions, and then goes forward in time to when she is an adult, worried that she has wrongly helped put a man in prison for the crime. And so he is on death row and is about to be executed. So the book is very much about both the march to the Texas death penalty and also about using mitochondrial DNA to identify old and degraded bones.
Mm. And this new book, then, Paper Ghosts, is a follow-on from that story.
It has a similar feel to the cover, so that's, you know, but this one I like to call kind of a creepy road trip across Texas. It's sort of a spooky slow dance between a possible serial killer who claims dementia and a young woman who's desperate to know if he killed her sister years earlier.
Mm.
I wanted to put two characters on stage in a very intense and intimate way, like in a play almost, And the young woman who's the voice of the novel has sort of obsessively researched her sister's disappearance for years since she was 12. And now she's decided this Carl is the killer. So she draws these three red dots on a Texas map, like drops of blood, and springs him from a Fort Worth halfway house, and then takes him across the state to examine a bunch of cold cases. And the idea sort of is this play between characters. Who is really the crazy one? Who is really in control? Because, of course, he claims dementia, and she seems a very mysterious sort herself.
Wow, it's a great idea for a story. Was it fun to write?
It was fun to write, and it was especially fun to write because of the character of Carl, who amused me more than I thought he would. And I think it's Dostoevsky who says, you know, even in bad people there can be something good, and that is sort of what I found in Carl, which was interesting to me, a very complicated character.
Mm. So when, as a reader then, enjoying the book, do you think people will question themselves and whether they're supposed to believe one character or the other throughout the novel?
I hope they do. Yes, I certainly hope that is the case.
Yeah.
It certainly was the case for me while I was writing it. So
did you have a clear idea as to what was going to happen at the end when you were writing it, or was it a surprise to you as well?
It was a surprise to me as well. I am not an outliner. I'm one of those writers who sort of lets the characters guide me along the way. That may sound a little precious, but that is the way it works. And I find that way that I want to surprise the reader, and if I can surprise myself, I figure I can surprise the reader as well. What I really work so hard against is writing a novel where there are three possible suspects, and readers pretty much figure out which one it's going to be before the end.
Mm.
So
I have to ask you about your research. I know that you stood outside the Texas death house on the day of an execution. That must have been, wow, quite an experience.
That was probably one of the more profound experiences of my life. I really didn't expect it to change me the way that it did, but it was not sort of the busy place that you expected it to be. It was rather quiet. There were, you know, the fours were on one side and the againsts were on the other side of this building that looks sort of like an old courthouse. The death house is in a relatively small town in East Texas. And I think one of the most, I don't know, the thing that made me, I guess, quiver was that there were a bunch of retired police officers on the kill him side, and they roared their motorcycles as the man was being executed. It was a man named Edgar Tamayo who had shot a Houston police officer in the back of the head, and they roared their motorcycles so that he could hear them protest as he was dying.
Wow. So is there only, because I've not heard of the Texas death house, is this the only place in Texas then where this happens?
Yes, and it's been happening for 100 years, at least. Texas has, since 1982, my state has killed more than 525 prisoners.
But
Texas is the busiest execution factory in the United States, for sure.
Mm.
But the good thing about this is that is definitely declining, and that is partly because prosecutors are not going after the death penalty as aggressively, and also because in Texas now they're given the option of juries are given the option of life without parole. So that definitely helps.
Mm.
Because, you know, no one really wants to put someone to death to make that decision.
Mm.
So.
Wow, it's fascinating. I knew that it happened in Texas. I didn't know there was just one place, though. Have you already started your next novel?
Yes, so it is, I would say, at the very beginning stages. It is about a beautiful widow who gets involved in the mystery of a little girl with one eye who is found on the side of a Texas highway. And so she, you know, is working to resolve the mystery of this little girl who won't speak. And there's also a little mystery about the protagonist, as well as you might imagine.
Great. Well, in the meantime, if people want to get a copy of Paper Ghosts, it's out now and it's by Julia Heberlin, who we've been chatting to today. Julia, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
TRE.
Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from Norway is Derek B. Miller, whose acclaimed debut novel, Norwegian by Night, won the Crime Writers Association John Creasy Award for Best First Novel in 2013. A native of New England, Derek is the director of the Policy Lab and has worked in international affairs with the UN, governments and think tanks for the past 20 years. His second novel, The Girl in Green, was recently shortlisted for the Crime Writers Association for Best Thriller of the Year 2017. He's with us on the Book Show to talk about his latest crime thriller, American by Day. Welcome to the Book Show, Derek.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's great to have you with us. And how did you start writing, with all the different careers you've had, if you like? How did writing come about?
Writing started for me in 96, when 25. I had moved to Geneva, Switzerland, where I knew that I was going to pursue my doctorate. And I had gone to Sarah Lawrence College as an undergraduate in the United States, outside of New York City. And creative writing was, they had one of the first early creative writing programs for undergraduates. And I didn't do a lot of writing there, but I was surrounded by a lot of people who did, which I think really demystified the whole thing for me. I was always reading, and I started writing at that time, and by 96, when I moved to Geneva, I was really very alone. There was no real internet in my apartment. You know, it was pretty much the usual scenario, and I decided to just start diving into it. From then, I never really stopped, so in the midst of the studies and the work and the rest of it, this was always something that I did, and I wrote several manuscripts, and I spent a lot of time on my own trying to figure out, you know, what is a story? How does drama work? How do I, you know, what was my voice in producing this kind of thing? What kind of genres did I want to play with? That sort of thing. And by more or less 10 years later, I was sort of ready to begin to enter the wider world.
Mm. So why did you pick the sort of crime thriller genre, do you think, or did it pick you?
Well, I think that might be I don't think that's even today quite what's happened. I started off writing what I would broadly think of as contemporary fiction. Inter-family dramas and some pretty wild premises that I was playing with. But with Norwegian by Night, I had an idea for a story, and by structuring it around an adventure story, if nothing else, it gave me the backbone that I wanted to be able to improvise around that theme and begin to really tell the story of Sheldon and his relationship with his lost son. And by putting this young child in his care, it became a bit of a surrogate for the child that he lost, and then that relationship was able to be explored. So in that book, I almost inverted the traditional police procedural, because it wasn't really about the police or the procedural. It was really about Sheldon. And so I used that, the genre, as a way to get there. With Girl in Green, it was more of a war story, but it was definitely a thriller. It was definitely an adventure story. Probably now that the Gold Dagger is over, I can say it probably wasn't a crime novel, but it was definitely a thriller. And then with American by Day, I actually set out to write a mystery. And but it still straddles the line between a mystery and a contemporary fiction, because it's, now I've settled into the way that I write and the kinds of things that interest me, and I feel much more confident on the page at this point.
And was the way in which you wrote all three of the books, did you tackle them differently because they were slightly different subjects, or is the process always the same?
No, they're radically different. I mean, I guess in retrospect, the one thing that's similar is the first time I'm writing the story forwards, and the second time I'm sort of writing it backwards, because the first time I don't really know what's going to happen or what the story is about, and then by the time the draft is done, I do, and then I need to rewrite the book in order to bring it into alignment with what I now understand the book to be. But the Norwegian by Night was about a lot of themes that were on my mind at the time. My son had just been born. This was 2008. We were thinking of moving to Norway. I was thinking about the passing of my grandparents and the end of that generation. It was a very intimate story in that way. With The Girl in Green, it was I had written a doctorate that focused on Iraq, and I had all these stories from this from 1991 that I had absorbed from reading literally thousands of newspaper articles in Britain and in the United States and magazines and, you know, and congressional records and parliamentary records and all this. And I had, you know, sort of 7 years of intense knowledge in my head, and I needed to get it out in some new way. But it wasn't a nonfiction book. I needed to find a story that would be really compelling to readers. And once I began to see the sort of strange mirror between the 91 and the 2013 experiences and this girl in a green dress who dies in 91 and then somehow kind of reappears in 2013 and the mystery around that, that's when I realized what the story was, and all this material began to pour out because it had somewhere to go. It was like a piece of sand inside of an oyster, you know, that gives you an opportunity to form the pearl. And then this one was driven by just incredible, just incredibly upset by everything that was going on in the United States, with the police shootings and race issues and Ferguson and, you know, a few years earlier, Trayvon Martin and all these other kinds of big, massive questions. And then once I realized, though, that Sigrid from the first book, who had issues with immigrants and the immigrant experience in Europe and policing, once I saw the parallels, it's not identical, but when I saw the relationship is a better word between sort of policing and immigration issues in Europe and policing and race issues in the United States, and how there are some overlapping plates there, I suddenly saw the crossroads between those two things, and I wanted to go back to Sigrid from the first book. So, you know, each one is an adventure and a project of its own.
And has it been nice bringing the character back again?
Yeah, it's a joy. I think it's nice to go back and find those voices again and go back to the backstory. And it was also nice after The Girl in Green, I need to step away from that sort of giant geopolitical space back to something much more intimate and earthy and family bound in American by Day. And I really enjoyed that transition.
And why did you decide to set it in upstate New York?
It was about as dull a place as I could possibly imagine.
No offense to people who live there, of course.
I think when you take something that's supposed to seem, if you take something that should be exotic, that you think of as exotic, which loosely let's define as kind of freaks me out, right? Exotic food means stuff that kind of freaks me out. There's really nothing about upstate New York that kind of freaks you out. There's a lot of, you know, there's just people doing stuff, and there's some state universities and a lot of trees and some lakes, and then Canada, which isn't particularly freaky. And it's far and really far away from New York City. So sort of the influence of that sort of that dynamic Gotham metropolis is gone. I mean, it's far, far to the south. Because we're not talking the Hudson Valley here. I'm talking way upstate. Mm. And so there isn't anything exotic about it. So you expect things to feel familiar and normal. So if you take somebody who kind of seems familiar and normal, this sort of Norwegian cop, she's not from some place that you think of as radically different. You know, she's not from, I don't know, Kazakhstan or something. And when she goes there and she finds everything about you utterly bizarre, it's a better contrast than if she had been someplace that you think of as bizarre too, to find that bizarre. So it gives a chance to estrange the familiar. And I thought that would be a lot of fun. And coming from New England, which neighbors upstate New York, it was fun to pick on it anyway.
Mm. And she's looking for her older brother.
Right. Her brother had gone to America some 20 years earlier, and they were close, but they're estranged only because they had very different childhoods, because he had to move away when he was early, and he has gone missing because he started corresponding with the father, and the letters stopped under sort of rather mysterious circumstances, and the father's a little concerned about what might have happened to Marcus. Sigrid, because she has just gone through this, she had just shot somebody in an earlier book, and has now gone through this internal affairs investigation and the rest of it, and she's taking some time off. The father thinks that, look, why don't you go look for your brother? If there's nothing wrong, then at least the two of you can spend some time together, and I think it would be good for both of you. And if something is wrong, you're a cop, and you're going to be able to help solve it or help in some way, even if you have no authority there. And so so off she goes on this adventure, which she doesn't think is going to be a problem because she assumes that there's nothing wrong. And then, of course, she finds out that I think two chapters in or something, that he has been implicated in the mysterious death of his girlfriend, who is an African-American professor at the State University.
Mm-hmm. So are people very much behind the character of Sigrid?
How do you mean?
Well, do we like her? Do we want her to succeed?
Well, I should think so. I haven't really thought about it in those terms. I mean, she's, I think she's sort of hilarious because she has an extremely dry Scandinavian sense of humor, which I'm quite fond of. And it works quite well up there, especially when she meets the local sheriff, who has a master's from Loyola in divinity studies, and has recently started his second elected term, which she finds already bizarre that we would elect police officers, which is bizarre if you think about it. And she's a really full-rounded human being with a life. So I guess, you know, there's no reason not to want her to find her brother. But I think eventually as the story progresses, you begin to understand everyone's motivations, obviously, in a very different way.
Mm. Well, if people want to get a copy of American by Day, it's out now. People can get it from our website in the TRE bookshop section. And it's by Derek B. Miller, who we've been chatting to. Derek, thank you very much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Sue Roberts to talk about her debut novel, My Big Greek Summer. It's a feel-good, funny, romantic comedy about second chances. Welcome to the book show, Sue.
Thank you, and hi.
Hi, it's great to have you with us, and congratulations, your first novel. How exciting.
Oh, it is exciting. Thank you very much.
Have you been wanting to write this for a long time, I understand? It's been a dream, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. It was one of those things that sort of many years ago I thought, you know, like lots of people, I'll write a book one day. And then we've always had a busy sort of family life and children and things. And then when they grew up and left home, I thought, right, now's the time. So that's when I did it a couple of years ago, yeah.
And how did you find the process of writing a book?
Well, initially it was just an idea in my head and I thought, right, let's go and write it. But then as I started to write it, I realised it needed to really have some structure and some flow. And so I abandoned it once or twice, then picked it up again. But I think the idea for the story was so strong in my mind that it just sort of went ahead and sort of instinctively wrote it, really. It was all new to me. It was the first time I'd written anything so long. But luckily it just seemed to flow, and before I knew it, I was at the end of it, so...
And what's your connection to Greece? Why did you decide to set it there?
Just really love going on holiday. I mean, we've been to quite a few places in Europe, but there was a holiday to Greece that gave me the inspiration. We just went one year, and I thought, oh, I've got a nice idea for a book here. I just love Greece, in particular Rhodes, where part of the novel's set. Part of it's set in Liverpool, where I'm from, and part of it in Rhodes. So it was just an appreciation of Rhodes, really.
Yeah. And what's it like? How can you describe it? Because I'm a lover of Greece as well, so I'm with you all the way. But for people who haven't been, how would you describe it?
It's a story of a journey, really. It doesn't start off in Greece on the Greek island with the sun and sea. It's a story of a woman called Mandy who's in her early 30s, and She's been with her husband since a teenager, and unfortunately the marriage is on the rocks. He has an affair and she's down in the dumps, so she thinks, right, I'm going to treat myself to a little holiday, a place that she'd been to years before with her family. Takes off on her own, and things have changed a little bit in the village. So then she meets some friends and people at the apartments. And so it's a journey. I would describe it as a story of a journey and of moving on and coming to terms with the end of a young marriage.
So tell us a bit more about the character of Mandy.
So Mandy's pretty feisty, I would say. She used to be. You get the impression early on that she's sort of invested a lot in a marriage and very much become part of a couple, but you get little glimmers of how she used to be in the past. And then slowly, as she goes on this adventure alone, she starts getting her confidence back and she meets friends, and she's a lot of fun. She's a fun character and she's pretty feisty, and she gets on with everybody who she comes across. I think she's quite hopefully likeable.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like people will like her reading the book. Is that the plan? Yeah, people, you want people to get behind the character?
Hopefully, I think they'll sort of root for her, because she's been sort of really good. You know, she's had a close-lit friendship group and loyal in her marriage. But then you think there's a sort of feeling, did she spend too much time? She's a bar manager in a big bar, and she does spend a lot of time at work, and so does the husband. They're a bit like ships that pass in the night, but she's stuck with it. She thinks that we're in this for the long haul, but her husband has other ideas.
So what do we know about Danny?
Danny's very handsome, bit of a heartthrob, beautiful eyes, everybody comments on these gorgeous blue eyes. And at school he was a bit of the one popular that the girls liked, and she ended up with him. And they were on and off from about the age of 15, and then eventually they get married at the age of 21. Mandy's mum says, I'm sure that you're far too young to be getting married, but so she has reservations. But because it's her first love and everything, they get married, and then sort of 8 years down the line, things are not so great.
Oh, dear. And what do Mandy's friends think about the whole situation? Do they come into the book?
Yeah, one friend in particular, Hayley, who's really up for a good time and sort of saying, come on, let's go out and, you know, have fun, and trying to shake her out of it kind of thing. It doesn't really mention too many of her friends. She hasn't got many, actually, just one or two where she works at the pub. And they're all just very supportive, and they just really help her to get through, you know, the difficult part of a phase where her marriage ends.
So does she need to be convinced to hop on a plane and go to Greece on her own, or is that her idea?
That's her idea. She's feeling a bit fed up. And actually, the manager of the bar, the owner of the pub, has noticed that she's been making one or two mistakes, because she's heartbroken and her mind's not really on the job. So he kind of suggests a holiday, and she thinks, I don't want to be just sat at home, you know, in Liverpool. I'll be getting my mother phoning me every 5 minutes and stuff. So she thinks, I'm going to get away from everyone, just see and sun and read a book and just relax. So she goes online and books the holiday by herself.
And does she enjoy it from the moment she arrives?
She does, with one or two little mishaps, like getting terribly sunburnt on the first day and a couple of little fun things happen to her. But she does, so slow. When she first arrives, it looks a bit old-fashioned, a bit run down. The apartments are a bit, not quite what they look like on the online search. But then she realises that everybody there is just so lovely, and she meets people, and soon she's settled in very quickly, yes.
Fantastic. So without giving too much away, can you tell us a bit of what happens to her in Greece?
When she's in Greece, she becomes friendly with the apartment owner and also his son, Kostas, and he's more of a friend. She's just not in the... She's, you know, just going through this separation, and she's trying to get her head together, and she's not looking at all for any kind of anything other than friendship. But over the sort of 10 days that she's there, he's just a friend, and he says hello and things. But then together, when she's walking home one day, she notices this huge big empty field from across from the apartments, and she's with Kostas and says, what about this field? The village is very quiet and a bit run down from the way she remembered. And she has this idea then for a music festival. So he sort of helps her to try and plan it with local musicians and things like that. So he's very much a friend. And in the story, it's not all set in Rhodes. She goes back to Liverpool at some point to sort out a job and obviously try and sort out her marriage. So romance with anyone is out of the question, because she feels like she owes it to herself to try and save her marriage. But over time, backwards and forwards, things start to change. So as you say, without giving too much away, her life does become rather different towards the end.
Sounds great. So do you think there'll be a follow-up to this book? Have you already thought about a next book?
Yes, I've actually almost written a next book. I was contracted to do two, so I've almost actually finished the next one, which is set in the Lake District and Italy, so different place this time.
And how did you find the writing of the second book compared to the first?
That's an interesting question. A little bit more, I'll be honest, a little bit more difficult, in the sense that your first one is your idea, it's your spark that you thought of, your inspiration. The second one, you kind of write another one, so it's kind of write to order, if you like. But when I sat down and thought about places I'd been to, and following the theme also of a journey again, because I thought, well, the first book was a woman's journey in life, so this one is similar in that sense. But yeah, there was a lot more sitting down and planning and thinking about this one than there was with the first.
And has it inspired you to keep writing, though? Do you think there'll be more books from you?
Hopefully. I absolutely love it. You know, it was something I dreamt of doing, as I say, and then the time came, and I have really enjoyed the process. I've always enjoyed writing since I was young, you know. So yeah, hopefully. Definitely, I would say now I've got sort of a bit more time, I would definitely like to carry on.
That's fantastic. Well, best of luck with it all. If people want to get a copy of your debut novel, it's out now. It's called My Big Greek Summer, and it's by Sue Roberts, who we've been chatting to. Sue, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Hannah. It's been lovely to speak to you.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Eastern and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisisCLE.com/podcast.